Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Coming up on this week's show, the GameCube turns 20.
How to build your own Sega Saturn Mini.
And we chat to games designer veteran Jeff Johenigman.
The Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each week with our wonderful mates at Bitmap Books. Now, you need to check out one of my favourite books. It celebrates one of my favourite genres, The Art of Point-and-Click Adventure Games, a sumptuous 500-page hardback coffee table book celebrating the very best games that define that genre. You can check that out on their full range of retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.co.uk. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 293. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And nice to see you for our favourite part of the week, just before the weekend when we get to nerd out about all things retro gaming and technology and celebrate the golden age of video games with a very special guest as well. You know, I just realised actually this is our second to last show of September, only 6 weeks till Halloween now. Which is insane.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say something much scarier than about something which is in 7 weeks' time.
What's coming up in 7 weeks' time?
I don't know. Ravi might know.
It's the 300th episode, guys.
Isn't it? Is.
Yeah. We've been doing this. That Dan sounds ill-prepared. But yeah, you know, it's been good actually because we've been getting out there, haven't we? I know Joe went to a video game event recently.
Yeah, I went to the Birmingham Games Market this weekend just gone, which was my first kind of gaming, you know, market or whatever you want to call it, gaming expo, you know, in almost 2 years, which felt really weird being there. But it felt really weird being there without you guys as well. It was probably my first one I've gone to without you two. I went with my wife and daughter and some family friends. But it was really fun. It was, you know, bit of a buy everything Mortal Kombat kind of day, but you've been out and about as well, haven't you, Ravi?
Yeah, you see, you can kiss your wife and daughter, but you can't kiss us guys. Well, unless we let you. I've been out. I went to Swindon Retro Museum, and that was really cool. And I'm going to be going to a Leicester Retro Museum. I'm doing like a tour of the retro museums.
Yeah,
they're really good places just to sit and like get involved. And actually, we've got a story today which is related to Swindon Retro Museum as well. And what are you kind of planning, Dan?
Yeah, I'm off to a Retcon this weekend. So if anyone's going there at the Greenforth Community Centre, this is a show that I've wanted to go to for a few years now, but normally the date they do it on, it kind of falls in June, mid-June, when it's normally my wife's birthday and we're away on holiday. So it's I've not been able to go to it for the last, like, well, it wasn't on last year, but the previous 2 or 3 years. So they're doing it later this year. So I'm looking forward to that. Again, like you said, it's just, you know, getting back to normality, isn't it? And seeing people that you haven't seen for a couple of years.
Well, things are slowly starting up. Like even my Amiga group now, we're having another meeting as well. And actually, I'm not organising it, which is quite good because I'm going to be able to turn up and just enjoy it myself without thinking.
I thought you were going to say, you know, turn up blind drunk then.
So I don't smashed and wreck all the machines.
Get kicked out. But yeah, but it is nice that things are gradually getting back to normal now and these things are starting to open up again here in the UK. I know things are different all around the world, but, you know, slowly, hopefully we're all getting there over the next 6 months or so. Actually, I must admit this week, I've just really been playing Life is Strange on the PlayStation 5, which I know is a game that's a bit divisive. You know, some people don't like those kind of games. The thing I've been playing most on it, though, is there is a full Arkanoid clone, fully licensed Arkanoid.
I can't get in the corner with these modern games, can you?
You've done exactly what I said we would do when we get the next-gen consoles. You are literally playing a PS5 to play retro games.
to play an early 80s arcade game.
Yeah,
I was on it the other night. I must have played the actual game for about 20 minutes and then about an hour on Arkanoid.
So, classic.
Getting my money's worth from the PlayStation 5. I think you'd agree. Now, we've got lots of news stories to get into this week. It's been a very busy week, and we have got an amazing guest on the show in around 25 minutes from now. This was one that, because, you know, we do guests all around the world, one with quite a time difference. I think we recorded this at around 12:15 last week, Ravi.
Oh, God, yeah, because we were recording in Texas, and, you know, I thought, are we going to sound absolutely shattered on this? Because we did do a late one, but, you know, it worked out well because it was kind of the heat wave. So I was up anyway, and it was an absolutely amazing interview. It's with Jeff Johannigman, and he's an amazing developer. He's worked within so many companies like Electronic Arts, Atari, Epic, Microprose, Broderbund, Synapse, Dynamics. But his main kind of core of work and what we mainly talk about is Electronic Arts and their kind of influence that they had on all the other companies. You know, you had guys like Will Wright coming from Electronic Arts. You had a lot of Microprose influence with Sid Meier and all the secrets and the kind of behind the scenes stuff comes out because Jeff was an integral part, and he would work with all the different designers and kind of was friends with all of them.
Yeah, and he co-founded the Game Developers Conference with Chris Crawford, who we had on a couple of months ago as well. So, you know, he's got some incredible stories from that really exciting time in video games. You know, when you talk about like the early 80s to early 90s, I think there's so much innovation. And, you know, all the new generations that came along and the new hardware. I mean, we kind of nerd out about Sound Blasters and MPEG video cards and even going back to stuff like the PC Junior in here as well and the C64 and some really, really interesting stuff. And even like, you know, the PDP, like mini computers and that kind of thing. There's a lot in
here. And like, you know, EA, they were like a foundation company, you know, that they kind of started and then loads of people rooted off them. And we even find out, you know, why EA dropped the Atari ST, which is really interesting and juicy. So there's some great stuff in this interview. Really enjoyed doing this. Even though it was late at night, it was definitely worth staying up for.
Absolutely. So our special guest, Jeff Johannigman, he's coming up on the show very soon. Before that, as I said, lots of new stories to talk about now. On the day we're recording this week's show, actually, we're recording this on Tuesday, 14th of September. It is actually 20 years to the day that the GameCube launched in Japan. And I know you, because I mean, Ravi and I, obviously we play GameCube. I've got a GameCube now, but I think you're probably the only one of us that actually had a GameCube when it was new on the market back in the day, Joe.
Yeah, GameCube was like my console. You know, it was for me, like, obviously I had the Mega Drive and the SNES, and then we got an N64, but the GameCube was like the first kind of console we got when it was brand new. I mean, we got the PlayStation, but we got a dodgy one, which my dad got from the pub, and only like the Player One worked. But yeah,
if you want to hear those stories, check out the After Hours podcast.
But the GameCube was like my main console from about 12 years old to about 18 years old. I didn't get a PS2 and an Xbox, you know, until I was an adult, you know, much later on kind of thing. Obviously, I played them at friends' houses, but yeah, I adored my GameCube. I was always a little bit jealous that obviously it wasn't a multimedia player. I always thought that was really strange that Nintendo did the mini discs, you know, their own little discs, and they didn't play DVD and CD, you know, which is probably why the GameCube didn't do as well as the PS2 and the Xbox, amongst other things. But yeah, 20 years, like, that's just making me feel so old, because I was like 12 years old when we got
Did you walk around with the little handle and kind of like wear it like a bag?
No. No, I never did use the little handle, but I did always think it was really odd, and my brother used to always think it was really odd, and he'd come and take the mick out of my GameCube all the time. Like, you want to go to PlayStation 2? Because he'd moved out by this point and he had a PlayStation 2. And he's like, oh, it's a baby's toy. It's a baby's game. So I was really smug when Resident Evil 4 came out as an exclusive. I was like, baby's game, we've got Resident Evil 4, mate. And he was blown away by that. But interesting fact about the GameCube, which I only found out today, and it's one of those things that I probably knew but never really thought about, the first Nintendo console to not be released with a new Mario game.
It didn't come out
with a Mario. Mario Sunshine came out on it, but that was later on.
Yeah.
There was no launch Mario title, which is crazy when you think about it.
You think of the N64 and like that was all about Mario 64, the entire launch and the design of the system. And, you know, that was the big flagship game that was the main system seller, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I think the GameCube is quite underrated, you know, and I think it still has a legacy to this day with the Switch, like, and with the Wii U, how you could still plug the GameCube controllers in and people still play, like, modern Smash Bros. With the GameCube controller. Like, I think it's a really iconic, it's just, like, an underrated console, I think, you know, because it didn't actually sell too well, did it?
No, it actually, considering, you know, what we consider a failure, for example, the Wii U that I think sold around 18 million, didn't it?
Mm.
And everyone calls the Wii U a gigantic flop. The GameCube worldwide, 21 million.
Yeah.
So only a couple more than the Wii U, actually. So it wasn't a success compared to, like, you know, the PS2 that sold like 100 million more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the PS2 was like 220 million, something insane. And then the Wii was like 150 million, something like that. So yeah, like you say, it was, I guess, in some ways a bit of a flop, but. You know, I think a lot of people have a lot of love for the GameCube and a lot of nostalgia for it.
I think it had like, it was weird. It had like a kind of Dreamcast like fun to it with some of the controllers that you could get and some of the add-ons. What was that? The Donkey Konga was.
Oh, yeah.
And did they have maracas as well or something? I know that there was a lot of weird controllers. Fishing one as well, a fishing rod.
Yeah, there was. When you said that, I was like, what's he on about? And I was like, yeah, you know what? There's the microphone as well. It's quite a few, actually, now you come to think of it, yeah.
I know you mentioned the Dreamcast there, and I think that is another thing that the GameCube is remembered for as well. Obviously, when the Dreamcast got discontinued, the fact that we had, you know, a Sonic game on a Nintendo system for the first time when Sonic Adventure came out on the GameCube, that was a bit of a, you know, for Sega fans, I remember a lot of them being like, what?
That was very kind of controversial on the, you know, I mean, I was in secondary school by then, but I'll still call it the playground. But, you know, that went around school. That Sonic was on the GameCube, and you know, it was like Nintendo have bought Sonic. Like, that was just like, obviously, that wasn't the case. It was just Sega were publishing games on, you know, other consoles now. But like, at the time, it was so controversial. You know, it was like, oh my God, like, you know, Sonic Adventure 2 came out on it, and then Sonic Heroes, and that was it. It was just like, all of a sudden, in my mind and in my friend's mind, Sonic was Nintendo. Like, it was crazy. Mm.
And you know, it's hard to follow up the N64 as well, because the N64 was such a change in kind of, you know, in graphics, in gameplay style and everything. And anything would have struggled, like, to follow the N64, I think, because that was so, like, out there, you know, at the time when it came out.
And also, I reckon that, you know, what you mentioned then about the fact that it was purely a gaming system. In many ways, you know, the Switch is kind of like that today, isn't it? It's a system that, you know, all the other consoles, obviously the PS2 back then, it was really going big on the fact that it had DVD, and the Xbox, you know, that had like the home media stuff on there. And they were kind of majoring on that in a lot of the marketing for those systems. But again, it was, even though Sony used a tagline for the players, really Nintendo's been more about that, I think, you know, since that generation in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to mention there was the Panasonic Q version of the GameCube, which come out a little bit later, that did play DVDs and CDs and stuff. But if I remember rightly, they were incredibly expensive, even compared to like a PS2 or an Xbox. So I don't think anybody had them.
And that controller is quite divisive. I see a lot of hate for it online, but I actually really like the GameCube controller.
Interesting you'd say that. I mainly see people hyping the GameCube controller, saying it's one of the best controllers ever in gaming, to be honest. I see that quite a lot. I mean, could be wrong, each to their own, but like I say, it comes back to Smash Bros. Players, you know, these competitive players who still use the GameCube controller with all the different ports and cables and peripherals to make it work. You know, I really like the feel of the GameCube controller personally.
The only thing I don't like about mine is you know, the analog stick, that kind of yellow rubbery thing.
The C-stick.
Mine's kind of, it's got all sticky over the last 20 years. Now, that
I think it was like, you know, the N64 controller was like a three-pronged thing, and they basically ripped the middle prong out, which always confused people how to hold it or, you know, use it as a gun or whatever. They ripped that out and kind of redefined it with a GameCube, and they did make a nice controller, yeah. And even those wireless ones, that was really early on, wasn't it?
The Wavebirds.
The Wavebirds, yeah. So it's innovative, man.
It really was, and I think, you know, at the time, I mean, we talked about this in the After Hours podcast, if you check out our 2001 episode for the Patrons Only podcast that we do, the fact that at the time, I mean, that was kind of my gaming wilderness years, but I did kind of keep an eye on stuff, and I always regarded the GameCube as being like a console for little kids, probably because of the way that it looked and that kind of, you know, the Fisher Price kind of appearance and the handle.
My brother's a similar age to you, and he was so the same. It's a baby's toy. It's a baby's console. Why have you got that? You're 12 now. He used to give me so much stick for it.
But I think, you know, in terms of graphical power, it was, you know, I think it was actually the most powerful of that generation, wasn't it? So it was, really was a wolf in sheep's clothing. And a system that, you know, I agree, I think it was very underrated. So to celebrate the GameCube's 20th birthday, I'm thinking this weekend, you know, when I get back from Retcon, might get my GameCube out and have a little blast at a couple of classic games as well, because, you know, it is a system that I think deserves a bit more love. So happy birthday to the GameCube, 20 years old this week. Now, this is something I didn't think I'd see. A franchise that really has been a bit neglected over the last decade, and this is Driver. Now, of course, this was what many people considered the main rival to Grand Theft Auto back in the day. Turns out we're getting a TV series of Driver.
Yeah, so this was announced this week that we're getting a TV series of Driver for the video gaming service, TV service called Binge, which was announced this year, which is coming out next
Binge,
year.
Binge, I've never heard. Yeah, Peacock we had last time, I hadn't heard of that. Yeah. Now Binge. Yeah.
So it's a gaming-themed streaming service called Binge. That's all I know about it. And apparently the TV show is going to be on that. It's going to be an exclusive. So you know how like Netflix made Stranger Things and, you know, Amazon have got a load of shows they've made and stuff like that. This is going to be Binge's Driver. But like you say, bit of a dead series. You know, I don't think there's been a Driver game in about 10 years, has there?
There hasn't.
Yeah, 3DS was the last one in 2011, apparently.
Well, there you go. I was right, 10 years. And, you know, don't get me wrong, Driver was big on the PlayStation. You know, I remember it being really big. But I feel like that genre has been done so much, you know, with like Fast and Furious and stuff like that. And, you know, interesting that they've bought the rights to this for the, you know, the TV show to come out. But apparently there's been rumours of a Driver TV show all the way back from 2002. So this has been going on for 19 years. But apparently now they've Binge have bought it and they are going ahead with it, apparently.
Well, it's got that like... It was when it came out, it was bloody stylish. Like, you know, it had that 70s cop stuff, and GTA tried to do a few things like, you know, driving through like boxes and stuff like that, and kind of had that in the initial GTA 3. But Driver had that kind of 70s vibe, that slickness. Mm. Like, the soundtrack was absolutely amazing. Alistair Brimble did that, and actually, he's done a Driver 20th anniversary, and the soundtrack was really good. And also in this article, they mentioned that there was a director film mode as well, which I totally forgot about, where you could make your own little Driver movies. And I do actually remember sitting there making, like, you know, little movies. And
my brother used to make them just flying through the boxes, like you said.
yeah, flying through the boxes, and also doing it from different camera angles. But there's real like 70s cop ones. So I can imagine like a kind of Starsky and Hutch style TV show, maybe.
Now you've kind of like put that out there, you know, I can see it being different from like...
Have you seen Baby Driver? Like, you seen Baby Driver?
Yeah.
Maybe like that as well, kind of.
Yeah, that's quite a stylistic film, isn't it? So, yeah, maybe they'll go with that kind of vibe. But like I say, it's just odd choice. I think they could have done something like that without the driver license.
You know, I'm wondering though, because obviously Grand Theft Auto is so big these days, even though I've been seeing all the backlash this week about the version that they're releasing for the PS5 and Xbox S, which is virtually identical to the PS4 and Xbox One versions.
Trying to get GTA 6.
Well, that's the thing. They're trying to get the people to buy the same game three times on three different generations in under a decade. But the fact that it is, you know, the biggest selling entertainment title ever, maybe Ubisoft are looking at that and thinking it's time for a Driver resurrection, you know, like maybe a full new game, which I think will probably do quite well.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe they'll tie it in with the TV show. We'll see. But yeah, this isn't scheduled until 2022 anyway, which, you know, feels quite a way away, but it's only from 3 months' time.
Yeah. Next, we'll get the true crime game, True Crime Streets of LA.
The TV show of true crime.
So we'll keep an eye on that, and then we'll link up what we know so far in our show notes at theretrohour.com. You mentioned only a few months left of this year. Maybe you're starting to think of Christmas present ideas. This one that's going to be out next month, Super Mario 64 Lego. Now, when this got announced, literally just after we recorded last week's show, I sent it over on our little Facebook chat group that we have. Joe was like, oh my God. Then we looked at the price, £160.
Yeah, yeah. Ravi needs to get saving to buy us both one of these for Christmas. But this looks really cool. This is the Super Mario 64 ? Lego set, which I can only describe as, you know, it's the yellow ? Box from Mario 64, you know, from the iconic box from all the different Mario games. But it feels very similar. Like, obviously it's a Lego set and it's really cool, but the way I don't know if you guys have watched the trailer, but the way it comes apart really reminds me of those old 90s like Polly Pocket and Mighty Max toys.
Yeah, so I was about to exactly say that. And the size of it's yeah, really kind of small, isn't it? Yeah,
so I do feel it is quite expensive at £160, $170 in America, because it's only 7 inches tall and 7 inches wide. But yeah, you take the top off, which does look really cool, like the mechanics to it. And as you take it apart, the Mario 64 worlds come out of it. And you get 3 worlds in there, which are Peach's Castle, Bob-omb Battlefield, and Cool Cool Mountain, which are essentially the first 3 levels of the game. And they look really cool, like little miniature Lego sets on there. And you get like 10 little miniature Mario characters. You get like Mario, Yoshi, Peach, King Bob-omb, the Chain Chomp. You get like Lakitu, and you get the penguins as well from Mario 64, which I really love. It does look really, really interesting. And I do love that they've used a retro, you know, Super Mario 64, because there's loads of Mario Lego out now. And I feel like this is the first time we've seen like the proper retro stuff other than the NES, obviously the NES Lego set. So it's pretty cool that they're showing some love to Mario 64, but it does just feel a bit expensive. But then Lego is really expensive.
I feel like this concept of having like, you know, a cube and levels coming out of it and stuff associated with a game, maybe you could do a like Crash Bandicoot, or you could have like a barrel for Doom.
Yeah.
Like, you know, everything inside that, and maybe they can expand it, but I'm gonna wait for the Poundland Blocko version to come out and get you that for Christmas.
Oh yeah, I'd be happy with that as well, to be fair. But you know, it looks really cool, and Lego have reported that apparently the you know, the deal they've done with Nintendo, the Mario Lego, has been selling really, really well. They've done really, really well off the back of it. So this definitely isn't the end of the Nintendo Lego sets.
It is the kind of game franchise that lends itself well to that, I think. You know, the similar kind of audiences, I imagine, are into Lego and Mario games, especially with stuff like Mario Maker, which is essentially just, you know, a virtual Lego builder, really, on the Switch. And yeah, like you said, a bit pricey, but I'm actually looking at this again. I mean, when I first saw the headline, all the lands and stuff in there, I didn't know if they were separate, but they do come with the cube as well. So you do get quite a lot for it. I mean, and, you know, paying £160 for Lego, it's a bit ridiculous, but as a collector's item, you know, if you're a big fan of Mario 64, I think, you know, that there probably will be quite a lot of people that are prepared to pay that for it.
You know, I'm all for Lego, like, because kids these days are always on screens constantly, and I think it's a good kind of escape just to sit there and build it, even if you are doing something that's themed on, like, a video game or something you would play on the screen. It's, like, just a different way of kind of enjoying it.
Now, this is quite an interesting story. Some early Spectrum games from a long-forgotten developer have now been rediscovered.
Yeah, so this story is about a developer called Roger Diamond, and it's actually comes from the Retro Museum of Computing in Swindon and the Digital Orphanage, a.k.a. Keith, and he's kind of been looking at this developer and finding more information about him. He's a bit of a lost developer, you know. There's not much info of him online or anything. And he did some titles, and they're originally Z80 versions, but they seem to have found the Spectrum versions and kind of done them up. The first one's like a roulette game. And, you know, the family actually contacted the museum, and they drove and gave the original tape. And it's been 16 years since they were able to, since they first visited the museum. And then Keith's managed to get back in touch with the parents and inquire about this software. So they had it for a while, and they didn't really know what it was and how significant it was until they found out about his story.
Well, it's a guy called Roger Diamond, isn't it? And he passed away in 1999, so you know, quite a while ago now.
Yeah, and it was like a family-run kind of mail-order business. Like back in the days, you know, you had all these people selling from the back of magazines and stuff. But he did a series of games. The first one was like a roulette game. The second was a games compilation, which is, you know, updated versions of these games for the Spectrum. And then a gambling one as well, tape, because they're always in tapes. And then finally, he did an arcade one called Diamondoids as well, which is kind of like a Space Invaders clone for the Spectrum. And it looks really good fun. And, you know, the kind of question is like, what he could have developed in the future? What other stuff have they missed? And, you know, it's good to have a tribute to one of these old developers after years of people not knowing much information about him.
Especially back then. I mean, you think early 80s, a lot of people were making software. Because, you know, the home programming scene, the bedroom programming scene was very big back then. But before we were all connected online, the amount of people that must have made really good things in their bedroom and then just never put them out to the world. And, you know, the fact that they're now finally getting discovered and people can actually see them, I think that's pretty special.
Yeah, and like, it's an interesting story about how he kind of had to rescue the tapes and, you know, restore them, essentially, take them out of their casing and get them to be read again. And, you know, he had one of the only master tapes, like, available. And now it's archived online, so everyone can kind of enjoy it. So I think that's really good work. And, you know, I went there recently and I hadn't been to the Swindon Museum for about 2 years with COVID and everything. And I came back and it just felt great just to go in there. And I kind of went in a bit slyly as well. I put my mask on. No one recognized me. I didn't tell anyone that I was coming. And I sat in the corner and I just kind of listened to guys arguing about operating systems. And I was like, ah, that's nice. It was kind of like soaked in the flavor while I was playing Mortal Kombat on my own.
They did put it on our Twitter, actually.
Oh, okay. They knew. I thought I was being stealth. But yeah, it was just a really good thing and a really good place. And, you know, they're really into their specy. So this is really important and interesting to see.
Yeah, I think it proves as well how reliable tape as a format for archival actually is. She said, you know, these are like 40-year-old tapes and still readable. And actually, I've been watching a YouTube channel. There's a guy called a Dune Basher. And he's got some really good high quality recordings of, like, you know, TVAM and It'll Be All Right on the Night from like the late 80s and stuff. And they actually look amazing quality, like they could be on TV today. And the other day I was actually, so we've got a family event coming up in a few weeks, and my auntie gave me her wedding video from 1989, and I've ripped that onto an MP4 file for her. You know, it still looks as good as the day she recorded it. Even though obviously it wasn't high definition format and things, but I think it does kind of feel like tape as a medium. The magnetic media formats tend to survive a bit better than, like, you know, something like a CD-ROM, which, you know, tends to rot after a decade or so. So,
well, it's also audio, so you can capture it and you can clean it up and you can process it through the computer as well, which really helps, and do all this stuff that you couldn't to actually, you know, extract a clean kind of signal out of there.
You know what I've got here? Listen, this is actually a cassette tape from 1988 when I was a kid. Me and my mum, we made a fruit machine simulator for the Commodore Plus 4. So I've got it. I haven't actually tried it yet. I found it the other week, so I'm going to actually give that a try.
You need to release it. Retro Hour Soft.
Yeah. That would be. So if the Swindon Museum want to put my fruit machine simulator with my mum in there, I'll send you the tape, although no one probably wants to play that. I don't think it actually worked in the end. We'll give it a try anyway. So yeah, very cool though. So if you do want to check that out, that story, and read more about the Swindon Computer Museum, it's on Hackaday. I'll link that up in our show notes as well. Now, before we get into our chat with this week's special guest, Jeff Johannigman, he's coming up in just a moment. This is a really cool story. I mean, we talk about the mini consoles all the time. Of course, the internet's been going crazy over the Amiga Mini recently, and I think that's going to be Joe's gateway drug into the world of the Amiga when he gets his hand on one of those soon. But there are other systems that we're fans of that maybe weren't all that commercially successful, or maybe haven't really got a chance of ever getting a mini version of them. And I think the Sega Saturn is one. I know all of us guys have got Sega Saturns. We're all fans of the system. In particular, Joe, I mean, you're probably the only collector that I know for the Saturn. And you've got quite a big library of games, particularly the Japanese ones and stuff, haven't you?
Yeah, well, you say it... This is the funny thing. When you say, oh, he's got a big collection, I've got about 40 Sega Saturn games, which is pretty expensive for the Saturn.
Bigger than anyone else, I know.
Yeah, bigger than anybody else I know as well. But yeah, this is interesting. We've been begging for a Sega Saturn Mini, and like you say, it's probably not going to happen. But it is a way to make your own Sega Saturn Mini, it would appear. So I wasn't aware of this, but Bandai, you know, like the toy and game company in Japan, released essentially a Sega Saturn model kit, from what I understand.
Yeah.
And now what's become available is a Raspberry Pi CM4 Sega Saturn board. So essentially you can put this Raspberry Pi board in the Sega Saturn mini model kit and make your own mini Sega Saturn. Which just sounds insane.
Because this does look like, and I hadn't heard of this as well, because I think we probably would have covered it if we had. Yeah, only on sale on Japan. You can actually get it off the Japanese Amazon store. I was looking at it before the show. And it is, yeah, it's a mini Sega Saturn. And I looked at it first of all, and it had what appeared to be a circuit board in there.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, is it a workable machine? But you're looking at it, and it's actually just a piece of card by the looks of it that's got a circuit board printed on it.
Yeah.
So it's not actually working. But yeah, what this guy's done, and this is really cool, we'll link up the full video as well if you want to check it out. Retro Game Restore, this is from. Now, they've actually taken apart one of these little models and put in a working circuit board with a Raspberry Pi on there that means you can actually play Sega Saturn and anything else the Raspberry Pi could emulate, I imagine, on something that looks like a mini Sega Saturn.
Yeah, and it fits exactly inside it, and everything's perfect, laid out,
yeah,
laid out for it. So it looks absolutely mental. Like the fact that, you know, you've got the control ports at the front and they're micro USB, and it just, it's like it's designed exactly for this. It's like it's factory made, and you kind of plop the Raspberry Pi into the top of the board. And you know, you can run RetroPie and then run emulators in there as well, but there seems to be some extra connectors in there, and that, you know, it looks like, I don't know, is the CD-ROM working in it? I know there's a picture of the CD there.
That's only one from the pack, I think. When you get the model kit,
the actual console. Yeah. If you look, the actual console itself's only about the size of a Sega Saturn controller.
Yeah, it's tiny.
It's tiny, but yeah, the he does have a fully functioning RGBS cable, which is what the Saturn had working on there. So you can plug it straight into a CRT TV as well,
wow,
which is really cool.
Yeah. And also it's got different versions, right? So one's got like built-in Ethernet as well.
Well, there's a video by ETA Prime, fantastic YouTube video, and I'll put that in our show notes as well. And it looks like there is going to be like some more add-on boards coming out for it too. And you get stuff in here, like obviously you've got your micro SD card slot, there's a 3.5mm audio jack as well. Even a port in there to connect a mini fan to it, which, you know, because sometimes the Raspberry Pis, they do get warmer than you expect. I generally, you know, if you're going to overclock them in particular, which I imagine I've never tried Saturn emulation on a Raspberry Pi before, but I imagine it's probably a bit more demanding than, you know, doing something like the Super Nintendo, for example. So it's a good idea to probably have a bit of additional cooling in here as well. But it looks like this is pretty much, you know, drop the Raspberry Pi onto this custom board, pop the case open of this mini model kit and close it up, and then you've got this working Sega Saturn Mini. So it looks pretty straightforward. It doesn't look like it requires soldering, and because normally these are, you know, we think these projects are kind of cool, but they're all way too complicated for our skills, aren't they?
You know, the mad thing is as well, it's got like, you know, the little slot at the very back that you use for putting in the VCD drive.
Yeah.
That's actually the HDMI output as well. So you can just take the little flap off, and it you're right, it seems to work absolutely perfectly. And, you know, there's a few of these things out there, isn't there? There's like the 32X, that stack system as well that was made.
Oh, the models.
Yeah. And maybe people can get other systems that have their own little model kits and start putting boards in them. I think it's a really smart idea. If you've got the case and enclosure, you might as well use it and turn it into something.
And like you said, Joey, you know, the fact that Sega are probably never going to make a Sega Saturn Mini. And, you know, what's he all saying? If you want something doing properly, do it yourself.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
These kits are out there now, so very cool. Now, can we just take a quick moment to give a big thank you to a really good supporter of the Retro Hour podcast, and this is our wonderful friends at ExpressVPN. Now, ExpressVPN makes you get more value from the services that you're already paying for. Because you know what it seems like? You know, when you're doing streaming services, you know, Amazon Prime and Netflix, it seems like the prices go up all the time. And I don't know about you, but I generally watch a bunch of shows and then I'm struggling for something to find on there.
Totally. Like I've started actually going back and looking at older seasons of stuff, you know, rewatching what I'd watched before because I'm running out of content. But with ExpressVPN, I'm actually able to watch stuff in HD from other countries. And I've been watching. Yeah, this is one that you really like, Dan, Halt and Catch Fire.
That is an incredible show, isn't it? Which is now on the American Netflix. And obviously, if you love our show, it's kind of a dramatization of the early computer industry. You know, it's kind of based on the story of Compaq. It is a really good show about, you know, the earliest days of the PC industry and then moves into like the early internet era as well. So, you know, if you love shows like Silicon Valley, that kind of thing, Halt and Catch Fire is incredible.
Oh, yeah.
And you can watch it on the American Netflix now.
And Stargate SG-1, of course, and on the Australia one. I've been getting a bit of comedy with Philip Banks and Carlton Banks with The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. You know, I love The Fresh Prince.
That is one of those shows I can just watch over and over again, never get bored of watching
so
The Fresh
Prince.
So
many episodes of it.
Well, this is what you can do with ExpressVPN. So it lets you change your online location so sites think you're located in different countries, because there is almost 100 different Netflix libraries around the world. So you can just change your country and tap into all of these programs and shows that you don't normally have access to. And it works with other services too, like Hulu, BBC iPlayer, YouTube often has region lock videos. You can unlock those as well. And as you mentioned then, I mean, streaming in HD is no problem. There's no lag or anything, is there?
No, not at all. And it's like really easy. I have it on my PC. So when I start on my PC, it starts up Express and it's like so fast that I forget that it's actually on quite a few times. And, you know, you can have it on all your devices as well. So like phones, laptops, media consoles, have it even on your smart TV. So it's a really wicked service. Recommend it. You know, it's one that we use on this podcast.
So if you're looking for a VPN service and it opens up so much more to you, use the VPN that we trust and use, ExpressVPN. And actually, we've got you an amazing offer. You can get 3 extra months of ExpressVPN on a 1-year plan for free. All you have to do is use our link, expressvpn.com/retro. And of course, support our sponsors and keep the podcast going. Thanks to ExpressVPN, expressvpn.com/retro. Now, it is our favourite weekend of the month when we all get together on Sunday evening. We're going to hang out with our patrons. I always look forward to this because I don't know about you guys, but whenever we get together, I always kind of think like, you know, what am I going to talk about this month or what am I going to show off? I've actually been messing around with, it sounds really nerdy, but an operating system called Arca OS, which is kind of like a modern version of OS 2. That was an operating system that IBM and Microsoft did a collaboration on in the late 80s, early 90s. Kind of failed, but there is a new version of it, and I've been doing a YouTube video on it. So it's going to be interesting to chat to some of the guys about kind of what they know about OS 2 and that kind of stuff. And also showing off, I imagine Joe's going to have his Mortal Kombat collection that he bought last weekend. You bought Mortal Kombat on the Amiga, even though you haven't got an Amiga last weekend.
I gateway did. Drug.
I did. I was on buy everything Mortal Kombat, and I was with my friend Jason, who's got eyes like a hawk, and I kid you not, he was just spotting Mortal Kombat everywhere. And within half an hour of being there, I was like, mate, I've bought everything. Like, what are you doing to me?
But yes, you officially have one of the worst versions.
Not according to the box. It's one of the best.
I didn't
versions.
Mind the Amiga version. It was better than the Street Fighter 2 version on the Amiga. Mortal Kombat.
There we go. I'll have to get an Amiga now.
Load disc for fatality. Swap disc for fatality.
There was a bit of that, admittedly. But this is what we do once a month on a Sunday night for a couple of hours. We all just hang out. We all get on Google Meets. Our patrons come on there. There's a bunch of us on there. And we just nerd out about stuff like that. I was trying to find something in my cupboard the other day, and I found an older Toshiba mini disc player, and I remembered our conversation on there last month about mini discs, and thought, I'll have to show that to the lads this weekend.
I've just got a PlayStation, so leads nicely into what we're about to talk about.
Yeah, so there's obviously, you know, already some stuff that we're planning on talking about on Sunday night. And if you want to come along and join us as well, it's a bit like a virtual users group. We just all hang out and, you know, reminisce about nostalgia, and there's a lot of movie chat and stuff as well. We'd love to see you there. So that's going to be happening this Sunday night from 8 p.m. UK time. All patrons are welcome. And actually, for supporting the Retro Hour podcast, there are other tiers that you can get as well. You know, if you're a gold member or above, you get access to our patrons exclusive podcast, the Retro Hour After Hours. Now, Ravi's commitment, he actually went out and bought a PlayStation just to record the next episode we're doing.
Episode, and you know, the funny thing, Dan was like, oh, it might be chipped. And I was like, well, let's just burn a game and put it in. And it is. So now I'm going to play everything. Of course, I own the originals, but I'm going to play everything we're going to talk about on the show. And, you know, we're going to talk about our PlayStation memories, because that was such an impacting console. It changed everything the PlayStation did. Mm.
Yeah, we've already done Super Nintendo. We've done Mega Drive.
So
PlayStation.
Now it's PlayStation's turn. I felt like we missed a trick. We should have done GameCube.
Now we know it's the 20th.
Dreamcast next
time.
Dreamcast N64. Maybe once I've played the Amiga, we'll do the Amiga.
Oh, that'd be a good one. So this is a patrons exclusive podcast we do. We do one of these a month. Ish, you know, sometimes we might get a couple in a month. And there are now, this will be our 16th episode of that. So if you back us on Patreon, you get access to all the back episodes as well. You can check out the entire catalogue of them. And we kind of alternate, you know, we do system deep dives. So we'll do like an hour and a half, up to 2 hours sometimes, just talking about our memories of a system, talking about the launch games that came out, and a lot of news clips and stuff from the time too. Really going in depth onto the systems. And then the alternate episodes are looking at retro years. So we've done 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002. So we kind of, you know, again, just going in depth into everything we remember from that year and the new launches and everything. So if you want to get access to that, if you back us on Patreon as a gold member or above, you can get access to that. And we're recording a new one this week, actually. So a new one will land on there. Everyone gets invited to the patrons hangouts. And also everyone gets the normal podcast ad-free, and you get it early most weeks as well. But really, the main reason for backing us on Patreon is to support this podcast, because we can't emphasize enough how it just keeps us going, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. Like, I remember, you know, for years we did this podcast without any kind of support, and it was all coming out of our own pocket, and it was a bit stressful. Yeah. And, you know, just having you guys kind of supporting it, and like supporting the fact that we have an interview every single week and hunt down these amazing guests and, you know, kind of bring it to you. And even though it has advertising, it's kind of free for everyone. So even with the patron, you're kind of supporting that model where it goes out, you know, worldwide on all the podcast networks, and everyone can hear these great interviews and content as well. So we really appreciate it. And especially during this COVID kind of period, you've helped keep this show alive.
Yeah, because I mean, about, you know, 18 months ago when we used to record this in a radio studio that I work in during the day, and then suddenly Ravi and Joe couldn't come in, and we had to fork out, I think we paid about £5,000 for all the equipment, didn't we, to set up our home studios.
Yeah.
Something that we couldn't have done without our patrons. You know, the show would have stopped 18 months ago. So it is really thanks to you guys. We hugely appreciate your support. And all the money we get off Patreon, we put it into a big pot, and it pays for anything that we need, all our hosting costs, everything. So it's all covered, and we don't have to fork it out of our own pockets to keep the show going, really. So thank you so much for your support. And of course, for backing us on Patreon, you will get a mention in the world's most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. And a big thank you to our latest supporters. Thank you to Hyde 209, VGM Remixer,
Retro or Die,
Robert E. James,
Bestie,
and Chris Snowden,
who all backed us on Patreon. We hugely appreciate your support, and if you'd like to do the same, you'll find it at theretrohour.com. Right, if you're off to Retcon this weekend, I will see you there. If not, patrons hang out on Sunday night. Hopefully we'll see you for that too. All the details to back us on that you'll find on our website. If you listen on any podcast clients as well, a little reminder, we haven't had any new reviews for a while, I think, so they always really help. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, for example, or any other platform that allows you to do reviews, you know, if you can't back us on Patreon, we understand not everyone can, but if you can take 2 minutes just to write a little nice review and give us a few stars on there, that helps get the show in the charts as well. And of course, gets us closer to our ambition of finally top billing Gardner's Question Time on the Apple Podcast
Don,
chart.
Monty Don, we're coming for you.
So, yeah, please do that. That will be hugely appreciated. And next, then, we are going to be joined by veteran video game designer Jeff Johannigman. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for our favourite part of the show where we welcome on our special guest. Now, this week, we've got someone who's just been involved in so many incredible companies and also co-founding stuff like the Game Developers Conference, a programmer, designer, worked at Origin Systems, EA, Atari, Epic, so many companies. Let's welcome him onto the show. Hello, Jeff. How are you doing?
Doing very well. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Now, really appreciate you joining us. And before we kind of get into these incredible companies and games that you've worked on, we always like to find out a bit about your kind of geek credentials, you know, where it all started. Do you remember what initially got you into games then? Where did it all start for you?
Sure. Actually, back when I was in high school, and I was a geek back then before being a geek was cool, but I was still watching the daily reruns of classic Star Trek episodes. So I got to the point where I could name that episode within 20 seconds of tuning in at any point in time. So I was kind of a hardcore geek back then. And in high school, our high school had access to connection to the local university's PDP 11 mini computer. And
So that was like a mainframe, and you kind of had access to it.
Calling it a mini computer now, it would just, it was still refrigerators worth of computing power, but not quite as big as some of the big IBM mainframes and all. And I had a friend who had been writing some programs in BASIC, and he lent me a copy of one of the listings in BASIC, and I took it home and I started reading through it and went, oh, so this is what programming is. And the next day, I started writing a Star Trek game in BASIC for the PDP-11 when I was about 16.
Were you playing any other kind of PDP-11 like titles? I know Colossal Caves was a one that was really important.
Oh, yeah. We had the Colossal Caves. There was the classic Star Trek grid game. There was a Hunt the Wumpus. All of those kind of classic early BASIC games that, eventually you could get an issue of Creative Computing magazine and type in the BASIC code and play it on whichever computer you had access to.
And what was your first personal computer then that you had?
So back when I was in college, I saved up to get one of the early personal computers, and I was debating shopping around between, at the time, you had the Apple II, the TRS-80, the Commodore VIC-20, and the Atari 400 and 800 computers. Mm. And I could have probably bought any of the first three and had a fine time programming. But when I saw the game Star Raider on the Atari, I'm going, I have to have that computer. Star Raider was the coolest game I'd ever seen on a computer. And I don't know if you've ever seen it. Really cool effect in the game was when it was a point of view space combat game, and when you were transporting from one quadrant to the other, you went through a hyperspace sequence that replicated the Star Wars stars zooming past you, which
now I'm watching a video on it now. Yeah, it looks very impressive for the time.
I mean, for about circa 1981 or so, that was just mind-blowing. Yeah.
Well, what was your kind of setup then at university? I know you used tape, and was that the kind of, we use tape a lot in the in Europe and in the UK. Like, was that the cheaper option back then? And how much was it used in America?
We were still using cassette tape for a lot of the early PCs back then. So I think even if you got an Apple II, the default was to have a cassette tape recorder and so on. Back then, when I got my Atari, I think the disk drives were about $800, which, I think that'd be well over $1,000 today for that. And the cassette tape player or recorder was only about $150. So that was all I could afford, was the cassette tape recorder. And so my first two games that I had published, I developed and sent to Atari on cassette tape.
Well, how did you learn programming, and what languages were you using?
So, as I said, back in high school, a friend lent me a BASIC program, and I read through it, and it sort of made sense. I had to have him explain what a for next loop was. And then I actually decided to major in computer science in college So I learned all of the Pascal and C and some assembly language and so on. But my first two games were written in Atari Basic and barely squeezed it into when I first got my Atari. I only had 16K of memory in it. I had to later buy extra memory to expand it all the way up to 48K. So it was a 16K Atari 800 with a cassette tape and the basic cartridge. And that's where, when I created an arcade-ish game called Rabots, where you were being chased around a fenced-in field by a bunch of man-eating robot rabbits with long, pointy teeth and a mean streak a mile wide. And that there was at the time, Atari themselves were doing a catalog of user-written software. So users could send in a program, and if Atari deemed it to be worthy of selling, worthy of putting in the catalog, they would take care of all the duplication, distribution, yada, 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 and you get a 10% royalty on the deal. And as a college kid, first time I went down to the dorm mailroom and found an envelope with a check for like $300, I'm going, I'm going to be rich and famous. I'm now a published game designer.
Because back then it would have been just people kind of producing baggies and like little plastic bags, producing them at home and stuff. How did that catalog help then, the Atari Exchange program? Was it like a valuable Atari program exchange? Was it a valuable resource?
I think it really was. Using it? Yeah, I think it really was a valuable thing for the early owners of those Atari computers, because there weren't big publishers putting out a lot of stuff. So it was the hobbyists creating software for other hobbyists and so on. And actually, Chris Crawford, one of his first games was published through the APX catalog. So he basically got started that way with, I think the game was Eastern Front.
It's got that philosophy of like a modern app store as well, where you kind of create it and mm-hmm. There's a bit of royalties and then, you know, it's distributed, but mm-hmm. just really basically back then.
Yeah, yeah. And Atari also every quarter gave out awards for the best software that they had submitted and that they were publishing in each of different categories. So my second game, which was called Snark Hunt, was I think it took second place in the game in their game awards that quarter, which the award was $1,000 worth of Atari equipment, which is how I eventually finally got a real disk drive.
Well, another really exciting company. I mean, you know, one that's still going today, obviously, Electronic Arts. Mm-hmm. How did you get to work with them, and what were you working on initially?
Sure. Well, when I graduated from college, I got a job offer from Broderbund and did a couple games for Broderbund. Then they did a layoff. I worked at Epix for about 6 months, worked on the Commodore 64 G.I. Joe game. And shortly after that game was published, they had a layoff. And the timing was just about right that I applied to Electronic Arts at a time when they weren't hiring game programmers, but they did need somebody to do copy protection, which I really knew very little about, but somehow I lucked into convincing them to hire me at the time. And so I spent my first year at Electronic Arts, and this was back in the time when they had maybe about 40 or 50 employees. So, and I went through a really long interview process, about 3 different days worth of interviews, one of which included a meeting, sitting in on a meeting with some of their developers. And if you remember the early days of Electronic Arts, they first launched the company with this cool black and white rock star poster. Mm. Did you ever see the early EA rock star poster?
Yeah, I was going to say they tried to appear like kind of rock stars and
cry, yeah. I remember. Yeah,
it was basically a bunch of programmers who were really trying their hardest to look like cool rock stars. Not doing a great job, but doggone it, Trip tried his best. But when I was interviewing for the job, I get to sit in on one of these meetings and I'm looking across the table and going, oh my God, that's John Freeman. He was on the poster, and there's Anne Westfall and Paul Ritchie. Oh my God. I'm, you know, I was this fanboy. I was starstruck. And after I actually got the job at Electronic Arts, it wasn't more than about 2 or 3 months before I'm going, oh God, it's John Freeman again. He's going to drone on and on and on. So my fanboyishness wore off pretty quickly and discovered that they were real human beings.
You mentioned about copy protection as well, and obviously, I mean, that was always kind of a challenge for software companies, trying to keep one step ahead of the pirates. And, you know, just thinking back, I can't really think of any copy protection that wasn't eventually defeated. But how did you kind of approach that then?
I tried using the standard, trying to be really, really clever, working with the disk duplication companies to come up with the signatures that can't be reproduced on a standard disk drive, yada, 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 approaches. And after doing that for about 6 months, I eventually came to realize that my job was fighting an infinite number of hackers with an infinite amount of time. And no matter how clever I was, by sheer numbers, I was going to get outwitted in fairly short measure. So I put together a proposal for the executives and the whole team at Electronic Arts to basically say, let's stop doing copy protection, as in weird signature stuff on the discs. And let's start putting stuff into our games that enhanced the experience of the game. Put things in there like a full color star map or a code wheel or a paragraph booklet. So these are things that you need to have in hand while playing the game to be successful at the game. And reproducing them was not a technical challenge, so the hackers couldn't feel like, oh, I'm so clever, I outwitted the guy doing the copy protection. It was more just a pain in the rear, oh, I got to pay to go make a color copy of this star map, and that's going to cost me several dollars back then to make color copies of anything. You had to go down to the local copy shop, and color copiers were really expensive back then, or have to disassemble the code wheel that came with the game. One of the first games we used that on was a game EA released called Starflight. And Starflight, very good game in general, but the sales on Starflight were substantially higher than many of our other games at the time, simply because we had changed our approach to copy protection from being on-disk copy protection to being in the package game enhancements that were necessary to play. So I attribute some of that to not just the fact that it was an awesome game, but the fact that there were fewer people actually pirating it.
Why was Mule such an important title and such a fun title?
Mule is a game, you know, if you think about it, came out in the early 80s, almost 40 years ago. I could still boot up my old Atari 800 and play it and have a great time today. It is just this wonderfully balanced blend of competition and cooperation. It's an economic simulation. It is a game that is as well designed of a kind of multiplayer economics game as something like the Settlers of Catan board game is in many respects. So I think it was just one of the first really good implementations of a strategy game that was not an incredibly overcomplex war game, but it wasn't an arcade game either. It was something that really appealed to those of us who like to think a little bit with our games. And it just really hit that sweet spot.
But it was kind of multiplayer as well and turn-based. But
yeah, it was multiplayer. I mean, you did have computer opponents, so you could play it all by yourself. But it really was best to play when you could get two or three of your friends around. And it leveraged the fact that the Atari 800 was one of the first computers out there which actually had four separate joystick ports. So you could play with four different people simultaneously.
You know, when I think of iconic microcomputers from the 80s, obviously the Commodore 64, which I know actually held the title of the best-selling single model of computer just until like the Raspberry Pi overtook it about 2 or 3 years ago, I think. How important was that machine? And did you see like the computer scene kind of blow up with loads of new users coming in when the 64 landed?
Yeah, I think the Commodore 64 really was the first one that became an affordable home computer. Up until then, Apple IIs, TRS-80s, Ataris, they were really mostly appealing to the hobbyists, mostly because they were still relatively expensive. They were not cheap enough to be considered toys. They were not cheap enough to buy one for your kids. And people were still buying their, you know, Atari 2600 video game cartridge things for their family living room. And here came a C64, which was priced not much more than the Atari video game cartridge machine. And it really did take off. As a developer, I hated it because Commodore tended to be very inconsistent with updating their chipset. And you would find when you were testing games on the Commodore 64 that for some reason the game worked perfectly on this C64 and would crash and burn for some inexplicable reason on this other Commodore 64. And nobody had documented why this one was different from that one. So we had a lot of really frustrated developers. In the early days of Electronic Arts, we used to have an annual developers conference where we brought all of the authors who were working on games for EA together for a few days. And one evening, I snuck a Commodore 64 and one of their disk drives out of our computer lab and brought it over to the hotel where we had our conference and brought up a couple of baseball bats. And we vented our frustration with that Commodore 64. It's kind of like if you ever saw the ending of Office Space with their copy machine. We just head at it.
Well, it didn't resemble much of a Commodore 64 after all.
There were no two keys from the keyboard left stuck together.
Well, you worked on G.I. Joe for the C64. And
yes.
That was a huge brand, actually. Was there a lot of oversight from Hasbro with that game?
Hasbro had very little, actually, to do with it. The reason we ended up with that license was that Epix had recently hired a new CEO, Michael Katz, who came out of the toy business and didn't really understand computer games. So the first thing he did was do several toy licenses. He licensed Barbie. He licensed Hot Wheels. He licensed G.I. Joe. And even as we were developing G.I. Joe, in the model, they were just at that same point in time launching the cartoon series and relaunching the whole set of G.I. Joe toys. But Michael Katz, our president, was still thinking of G.I. Joe in the 1960s era with the 12-inch dolls and kept asking, which one of these guys on the screen is G.I. Joe? We had to keep explaining to him they're all part of a team called G.I. Joe, but I just don't think he ever quite got it. But I had a friend who had some bootleg anime tapes and was able to get the pilot movie that they had made before they launched the G.I. Joe cartoon, and we borrowed a lot from the images from that pilot movie that we got off of a bootleg tape. And one of the nicest things about working on that was that Epix gave me, at the time I was, 23, 24, and they gave me a budget of a few hundred dollars to go down to Toys R Us and buy as many G.I. Joe toys as I felt like. I'm going, wow, somebody's giving me money to buy toys as part of my job. That's awesome.
Well, one thing I always hear about that game is that there was no ending or no kind of objective right. or high scores. Like,
That was Michael Katz's idea to create what he called computer activity toys. And when he said, we're going to do computer activity toys, I turned to the other designers and programmers around me and said, what does he mean by that? And he said, basically, we're just going to design a game. We just don't give it an end goal. So you just kept playing forever, and you never quite felt like you won the game, but you did feel like you won individual battles, and you could keep going on and on playing with it, which kind of a dumb idea in retrospect, but that was what Michael Katz wanted, was a computer activity toy.
Well, no, G.I. Joe, looking at it, it's a very technically impressive game. I mean, you've got stuff like, you know, what we'd call today animated cutscenes in there, you know, lots of different locations as well. I mean, how did you kind of approach turning it into the game, and what are you kind of most proud of about it?
Well, you know what the animated cutscenes were for. It's because the Commodore disk drive took like 2 minutes to load up the next portion of the program. So we loaded up a really small piece of code to put up the cut screen and then animated a vehicle coming out of the G.I. Joe headquarters in a very minimal way just to cover the time that it's taking to load up all the rest of the game on there.
A lot nicer than a black screen.
Yeah, rather than a black screen and doing that. The thing that I was really proud of was, and it's something that people didn't actually make much notice of because it felt so natural, was that in the game, and I was doing the part which was man-on-man, people shooting at each other combat, but you could walk around on a street scene and your character could walk all the way around a car or a phone booth or something like that. And it clipped correctly and hid the parts of your character that were supposed to be hidden behind the car and so on and so forth. And I was really proud of that, but nobody noticed it because it just worked the way it was supposed to work. So I think that's the case really for a lot of people who work in special effects, is the best ones are the ones that people think is so natural.
Well, what did you think of the PC Junior that kind of arrived at that time, and what do you think caused it to be kind of not as popular as it could have been?
I think the PC Junior was too expensive still to be a home computer, and it was not serious enough of a work computer for anybody who wanted an IBM to take it seriously. So it kind of fell into this chasm in between. You know, if I want something for my kids, the IBM name doesn't mean anything to my kids. But I think the IBM PCs were more successful for the dads who wanted to have a serious computer to work on at home, and especially once people could come out with affordable PC clones, that's when that market really took off, was that dad could justify still, you know, buying it to do spreadsheets and work at home, but still have something that would play games for the rest of the family too.
That infrared keyboard probably didn't help either.
Yeah. And the Chiclet keys, I don't know if you ever tried typing on one of those keyboards.
Yeah, I've tried them, yeah.
They just were awkward and no fun. Yeah.
Do you think that kind of put developers off as well, and people were just like, we're not going to hit this system because it's not going to sell enough, and, you know, there's others out there?
Well, yeah. I think for the most part, the developers just, in some ways, even just resisted the idea of doing something for IBM. Because we all saw ourselves as counter-authoritarian rebels. So if you remember back in 1984, the original Apple Macintosh ads.
Yeah.
The 1984 totally
aimed at IBM, weren't they? Yeah.
So we were siding with that. And at the time when we probably should have started taking the IBMs more seriously, I was at Electronic Arts, and we were going full tilt for the Amiga. We were all convinced, Trip more than anybody else, that the Amiga was going to be the home computer going forward. It had the most amazing graphics, it had the most amazing audio support, it had a multitasking operating system, it had a great chipset in it, and it was everything we could dream a home computer should be, except for the price tag.
And I mean, you know, if the world was fair,
yeah,
it probably would have been the dominant computer platform. I mean, you know, Deluxe Paint, that obviously EA put out, you know, I used to live on that program as a kid, just making, when the animated version came out, number 3, I remember, you know, sitting at home making cartoons on it and stuff. And, you know, Electronic Arts were really behind the Amiga as well. I mean, was there a really big push to kind of support that platform there then?
Oh, absolutely. Within EA, we were putting more effort and more budget into developing for the Amiga, and kind of put everything else on a back burner. Even though, you know, the majority of our actual sales were still on 8-bit computers, even though we were making our bread and butter money off of Commodore 64 games and Apple II games and Atari games, we put our best developers and our best team and our best budgets onto doing Amiga games. And we also ticked off all of the Atari ST owners at the same time, because they thought their computer was every bit as good as the Amiga. And there's one Atari ST user who single-handedly killed any support that Electronic Arts had for the Atari ST. We were, at the time that we were developing for the Amiga, testing the Atari ST waters to see if games would sell there, and they weren't really selling that well. And Trip Hawkins himself was working late one evening when the phone rings, and he just, I'm not sure if pure whim, he picked it up to answer it instead of letting it go to the answering machine. And it was an Atari ST user calling to complain about how come you guys aren't putting out more games for the Atari ST. And Trip put on his best customer service voice and said, well, I'm surprised you say that, because we put out this game, this game, this game, and this game, and two more just this week. And the guy said, well, yeah, I've already got all of those. And Trip said, well, that's surprising. How did you get them all already? He said, well, I pirated them. So the next day, an email from Trip goes out to the entire company retelling that story and says, we are halting all development of all Atari ST games. Period. The end.
So any people listening to this that wondered why the Atari ST wasn't supported anymore, that guy was to blame.
Yes. I mean, we always suspected there was a piracy problem, but we tried to pretend that maybe we could still sell some. And this, you just don't tick off Trip.
How much did porting to all the different kind of systems affect the market and affect how EA worked? Because there was so much choice out back then.
Oh, I mean, it just drove us all nuts in trying to do all those conversions. And I was at EA, we were trying to support all of those 8-bit computers, trying to create really groundbreaking things for computers like the Amiga. We were a little bit behind the curve on supporting the IBM PC clones at the time. But also we were trying to support the Macintosh. We were trying to support the Apple II GS and so on. And so I think probably at least half of our development money went to not creating new titles, but just converting all of the existing titles to different platforms. And that was a colossal amount of friction to try to be able to reach your target audience by having to redo that for all of these different ones. A few years after EA, I went to work for Dynamics, which was owned by Sierra at the time. And we did some animated adventure games. We did some combat simulators like A-10 Tank Killer and so on and so forth. And I had an entire department of programmers and developers and artists doing nothing but ports, nothing but conversions. So the originals were then being created on for the PC clones, but then I got to turn around and put it on every other platform that we could. And at the same time, then also do the foreign language translations for Spanish and French and German and so on and so forth. So just the number of different versions of any game just multiplied out to a painfully headache-inducing number.
Well, in the late 80s, Electronic Arts published a very ambitious game for the Commodore 64 that also came out on the PC the following year. That was Dan Bunton's Modem Wars.
Oh, yeah.
How did that go for EA then? What was kind of the story there?
That game was one where it took practically equal amounts of effort between Dan Bunton, who was the game developer, and we had a dedicated programmer to just work on how do we make multiplayer modem communication work consistently and effectively so that the game wouldn't crash or drop or get out of sync or so on and so forth at the time between two Commodore 64s. And it was one of those cases where I think we were just painfully slightly ahead of our time. I don't think the 8-bit machines were really up to the real ability to do multiplayer gaming on a very successful and satisfying basis. But Modem Wars was a really nice little war game. It was fun to play, but it just didn't sell very well because I just don't think that the user base was there yet for Commodore 64s with enough people with modems to want to play games on it yet. But Dan Bunton was very, very passionate about seeing multiplayer gaming being the future of our industry. Dan used to wear t-shirts that said, "Stop playing with yourself."
Well, he was right, wasn't he? Yeah, got it right.
Yep. As a quick aside on that, you know, one of the people I had the greatest amount of respect for in the game industry was Dan, when I knew him as Dan, and even more so when Dan transitioned to becoming Danny Barry Bunton. And seeing a friend that I originally knew as kind of a shy, quiet, thoughtful, introverted programmer become so completely extroverted, so completely outspoken, so, "Oh, it's so wonderful to see you. Let's sit down and talk about stuff." Personality just emerged from Dan's transition to Danny. And it broke my heart when Danny died of cancer just a little bit over a year later.
What was it like in those early like online multiplayer kind of days? Like, were you guys frequenting BBSs in the office at all?
When I started at EA in charge of the copy protection, one of the things I did was I posed on a lot of the pirate BBSs just to kind of get a sense of who was out there, how are they cracking our code, and so on and so forth. And every once in a while, when I found a pirate BBS that was being really egregious, I'd sick our lawyers on them, and they would send out a little cease and desist letter, which was usually enough to scare them into stopping their operations for at least a little while. But yeah, I used to be on CompuServe, used to be on Genie quite a bit back then. One of the other things totally unrelated to the game business, but it was a lot of fun back in the mid-90s being on Genie when there was a TV series called Babylon 5, and you could log on to the Genie BBS section for Babylon 5 every day and get updates and comments and posts from the series creator, J. Michael Straczynski. So well before there was a World Wide Web that everybody was using.
Well, tell us how you got involved with Origin Systems then. What was the story there?
I left Electronic Arts in the late 80s. This was right around the same time that we were starting up the Computer Game Developers Conference. I had tried my hand at running my own separate independent game development studio and got a couple of ports done for a couple of different clients. But in a span of a couple months, I had three major projects fall out from under me from three different companies going bankrupt or just pulling the plug on them. So at the time that I decided to close up shop on my company in California, we were about to sign a contract to do, I think it was an Ultima conversion of some sort for Origin Systems. And they said, well, if you're not going to be able to work on this project in running your own company, we're going to have an opening for a producer. You want to come down and interview to work for us as a producer? And I'd never envisioned myself as a Texan. I don't wear cowboy boots. I don't wear cowboy hats. I didn't want to live around oil wells and tumbleweeds and all that stuff. I had this very, very Hollywood image of what Texas was all about. But they flew me down to Austin, and there were no cactuses. There was no tumbleweed. There were no oil wells. There were no cattle. It was a really cool overgrown college town with lots and lots of bookstores. And I fell in love with Austin. And came down to work with Richard Garriott and Chris Roberts right at the time that they were about to ship Ultima 6 on the PC, and Chris was working on the first Wing Commander. And my first project was to take the game engine that we'd created for Ultima 6 and repurpose it to a different genre. We had invested so much money in the Ultima 6 engine that we realized we were going to have to spread out the investment in technology across several different games. So we decided to try doing these, what we called Worlds of Ultima games, where we took the basic Ultima game engine, but rather than being in a swords and sorcery world of Britannia, we did a game set in a sort of Edgar Rice Burroughs lost world of dinosaurs and cavemen and primitive societies. And then we did another game called Martian Dreams, which was steampunk-driven trip to Mars. I got to work on Savage Empire. Warren Spector, who was the other producer at the time, got to work on Martian Dreams. And ironically, those two ideas were ones we had each pitched, but we had each pitched the other person's idea. I wanted to do the steampunk thing, and he wanted to do the Lost World dinosaur theme, but timing worked out that we ended up doing the other person's concept. For me, Savage Empire was one of the absolute best experiences as a producer, because I had an amazing team. I had a really great writer that I got to contract with. His name was Aaron Alston, and he had done many, many, many great paper game, role-playing game products, most notably for the Champions superhero role-playing game. And he was a delight to get to work with. And it was just, I still have to this day a photo of our whole team posed in safari gear, literally in our offices, which it looked like an outdoor waterfalls and jungle theme.
Ultima set the kind of foundation for modern RPGs. What was it like working on that series, and what kind of innovations did you see, and what ideas did you have around the Ultima series?
Well, the Ultima series, like some of the other RPGs of the day, like Wizardry and so on, were all set in this kind of generic Dungeons and Dragons sword and sorcery world. So we were one of the first ones to say, can we do a satisfying role-playing game, but in a completely new and completely different genre? in this case, the Edgar Rice Burroughs Lost Worlds kind of setting, or the steampunk world of Martian Dreams. So we repurposed a lot of the technology, gave it a different theme, but still connected it to the Ultima worlds through some of the moonstones and the mystique that was built around Britannia in doing so. But we did also have to tweak the engine a little bit, because when we're doing a game with dinosaurs, we had to be able to animate creatures that were much larger on screen than we ever had to do for Ultima. So that was probably the biggest technical challenge for us with Savage Empire.
Well, we've had Chris Crawford on the show before. And obviously I know you were involved in setting up GDC with him as well. Mm-hmm. How important was it to get that up and running, and how did your involvement start with that?
So GDC, actually back then CGDC, Computer Game Developers Conference, because we felt we needed to make a distinction between board games. We had great respect for the board game industry, and also a slight distinction from video games. There was a bigger chasm between the Nintendo, Sega video game world and our world of PC gaming. But anyway, it originally began, and Chris Crawford will take credit for the first GDC, which he says was the gathering of 24 people at his house in San Jose. And I was at that one, and the rest of the committee that started the first real conference formed out of that. So there were half a dozen of us who at the end of the day at Chris's house said, wow, we ought to really put on a real conference and try to get, you know, a whole like schedule of different workshops and sessions and speakers and so on and so forth, and maybe do awards and so on. So six of us from that day out of the 24 or so that showed up at Chris's house all volunteered to be on a committee to put on the first computer game developers conferences. And we found a hotel, the Holiday Inn Milpitas. And I ended up volunteering to be the person recruiting all of our speakers who were going to be doing all of our tracks of workshops and programs and so on. So I cannot count the number of times I had to tell a prospective speaker, no, no, really, trust me, the Holiday Inn Milpitas is a much, much nicer hotel than the name sounds. But it was, I think we had maybe 150 or so people come out for that first game developers conference in 88, I think it was. We gave out an award. We gave an award to Dan Bunton as, you know, the greatest game designer. And it was a really, to me, it was really, really important that we try to find a good way to build a sense of community among game developers, that most of us were working still in solitude. Most game developers working out of their home, out of their garage. There weren't a whole lot of game development teams and so on. So it was still a very small cottage industry at the time and very isolated. And this gave all the developers a chance to hang out with each other. And one of the interesting things that happened was we had asked the hotel, this is about the time that a company was putting out what was called Jolt Cola, which was a cola that had like three times the caffeine of normal sodas.
Yeah, the programmer's soda of choice, I remember.
Exactly. And we had asked the hotel to get a supply of Jolt, just kind of as a nicety, and then they misunderstood our request, and that was the only soda that they had available for us. So do you know what a convention of game developers after 3 days of drinking nothing but Jolt is like? Heavily wired.
Bouncing off the walls, I imagine.
Yeah, but there were several good late night poker games and lots of other fun stuff going on.
Well, I watched a video, and in it you mentioned that Sid Meier was saying to you, you know, he had several ways in which he nearly destroyed the Civilization game.
Yeah, this was a few years later in the early 90s. And I was no longer running the Game Developers Conference, but Sid was asked to do a presentation, a workshop for one of the annual Game Developers Conferences. And he did a rehearsal run of it for those of us who were working with him. I was working at Microprose at the time in the early 90s. And so he gave it a dry run, a rehearsal run of his presentation for us there. And it solidified that Sid is just genius. Sid is absolutely genius. And I don't know if you've gotten a chance to read his biography yet, but I highly, highly recommend his biography. It's a great book. But Sid, his basic premise for his talk was the 10 ways I almost destroyed civilization. And what it really came down to were, here are the decisions of things I was thinking about putting in the game. Here's what I ultimately decided would be the impact on the game itself. And that's ultimately, here's why I took it out of the game and kept it out of the game. Something like, I think one of the things he pondered was nuclear weapons. And he basically came to the realization that they were such an overpowering weapon to be used that there was no good way of counterbalancing it in the game. And so he just basically dropped it out of the game Civilization when he first developed it.
Well, speaking of other geniuses that you've worked with and that you know, obviously Will Wright. I mean, when did you first meet Will, and what did you think of his game design type when you first met him?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I consider myself to be, for anybody who's a comic book geek, Rick Jones. Rick Jones was the sidekick to every great superhero back in the day. And I can't really take much credit for any brilliant game that I did, but I got a chance to work with many, many brilliant game designers like Sid Meier, like Dan Bunton, like Richard Garriott, like Chris Roberts, and so on. Will, sweet, very nice, very affable guy. He and his partner were just launching Maxis at the time, and they had two games that were in development, one of which was a wireframe flight simulation game, and the other was this game where you are managing a city. And I got a chance to sit down and play test with both of those. And I said, well, I think this airplane combat game, this jet combat game, should probably do pretty well. There's always a market for that. I love this Sim City thing you're doing, but I really have a tough time imagining how you're going to market it and get people to want to play a game where you have to be a city manager. I don't see the market appeal to that. And I am really, really, really glad that I was proven wrong by the market in that case, because it really was. I stayed up way too late many nights playing SimCity.
It was an absolutely amazing game, SimCity. And it started that whole kind of genre.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you had Sim Earth and Sim Ant, and eventually The Sims, which I credit Will Wright with getting a bunch of guys in their 20s to play Barbie with The Sims. That's basically what it is Barbie Dreamhouse.
Well, you mentioned earlier Wing Commander, and with Wing Commander, it was a point when Sound Blaster cards came out, and there was a huge change in the industry. How important was it to get those Sound Blasters out there, and people having such a change in music?
Well, I think it really dramatically changed the visceral experience of playing a game, because up until then, you were seeing things, but all you were ever hearing were little weak beeps and boops in there. And suddenly when you can have a game that has a dramatic soundtrack, and I credit George Sanger and Dave Govett with doing some amazing work on the Wing Commander soundtrack and taking advantage of those sound cards to the degree they did. I learned so much about what makes, or how important music in a soundtrack is to a dramatic experience. George gave a talk at one of the game developers conferences where he took the script from Return of the Jedi, the scene where Darth Vader is about to die and he asks Luke, "Take off my mask, I want to see you with my own eyes," and reads the script out loud, and the dialogue is terrible. It is just painful dialogue to hear in and of itself. And then he plays the scene as it is in the movie, and with the music in the background, it just changes the whole thing from cringeworthy dialogue to tear-inducing drama. And it was all I think most of the credit for that just goes to the way that they played the soundtrack to bring everybody to tears. So George Sanger just pioneered so much of those early soundtracks and so much of how do you use audio well in games.
And he did a very kind of GDC thing as well, which was his, like, he'd do these sound barbecues where he'd get all the sound devs together and kind of try and get everybody on the same standard.
Yeah, if you ever saw, I guess you may have heard Project Barbecue, some of the retreats that he held. I helped facilitate a couple of those where he just gathered all the best minds in computer audio together for a couple of days of pure brainstorming and where do we want to go with the industry. And they were great experiences. I couldn't understand half of what they were talking about because my musical knowledge is nearly nil. I can't read sheet music at all or anything, but just hanging out with those guys. He had, if you remember Thomas Dolby.
Yeah.
Of She Blinded Me with Science, he came out and was in one of those Project Barbecues, and I'm totally fanboy starstruck at meeting Thomas Dolby. And I was listening to Thomas Dolby talk about when he got to meet Roger Daltrey and how starstruck he was, and I'm going, wow. So even big celebrities have their fanboy moments with bigger celebrities.
Well, obviously, when you mentioned the Sandblaster, but another big innovation that kind of went hand in hand with that around the same time was the CD-ROM drive coming along. And obviously, Wing Commander 2, CD-ROM edition. What were the changes there? And was it good to work on a title that, you know, had all this sudden expansion of space that you could put onto a CD-ROM? It must have felt limitless almost at the time.
Yeah, it really took us a while to figure out what to do with all that space. And I think one of the things we were most excited by, which turned out to be a really stupid idea, was some of us kind of got caught up with the idea of, oh, we can put whole movie sequences into the middle of our games. And so, yeah, Wing Commander series was one of the first ones to do that, and they hired Mark Hamill and all these other wonderful actors to put in these movie sequences in the middle of the game. And then we were all kind of shocked and horrified to see what our actual players did, which was, if it's not the game, I want to skip past all the sequences until I can get back to being in charge and being in control. So our audience really had very little desire to just sit back and watch scenes with Mark Hamill in them, even though we'd spent millions and millions of dollars to get it in there. They just wanted to get back to playing the game.
And I don't think you were unique in that respect. So many companies did that, you know, because full motion video, the first time you see it, yeah, it was impressive. But then after that, you know, it's not the reason that people bought the games.
Right. No, absolutely not. But it's very typical of learning what the strengths are of a new medium. And the strengths of computer games are interactivity. It's not in replicating what you can just watch on a DVD or in a movie theater. You know, the name of it is it's all about the interactivity and you being in control. And so there's not much patience for just wanting to sit and watch a passive movie sequence in doing so.
Well, your latest title is Master of Orion. And do you think it's important to still kind of push, and is it harder to push original concepts in gaming?
I think the industry as a whole has gotten a little bit more gun shy and a little bit less creative as budgets go up higher and higher. It's very much similar to, you know, Hollywood blockbusters. You don't see a whole lot of big budget Hollywood blockbusters that are doing anything really creatively risk taking. They've learned what formula sells and want to replicate it in as many different variations as they can. So I really enjoyed back in the early 90s getting to work on Master of Orion. It was, I think it really hit that sweet spot between a really good, deep, strategic game, but still being very accessible and easy to learn and easy to play. And as Alan Emmerich coined the term 4X, he was the one that created the term 4X games, for games where you explore the galaxy, expand your empire, exploit your planet's resources, and exterminate your opponents. So I give a lot of credit to Steve Barcia as the designer for finding the best way to balance out the depth and complexity with still being simple to learn and play. And then nearly 20 years later, somebody acquires the rights to remake Master of Orion. And they got the old band together, or at least as much of the band as they could find. They found me. They found Jeff D, who I had hired to do most of the artwork for the original Master of Orion. And they found Dave Govett, who had done the music for the original Master of Orion, to composed new music for the remake that came out about 4 or 5 years ago. And then they got Alan Emmerich as well, who had not really worked on the original game per se, but had done the strategy guide and had sort of been an informal consultant on that. So we got to be a panel of advisors, partially just to help them recognize and understand what made Master of Orion true, but I think also just for the marketing credibility to be able to say that, yes, we got the guys who helped build the original Master of Orion to be involved in the production of the new one. The new one, I think, was a really, really good implementation of the game. I don't think it quite captured the magic of the original one, but it did have something which I just completely geeked out over. And that is that when they remade it 4 or 5 years ago, they were able to hire voice actors, which we could have never dreamed of back in the early 90s, but they got voice actors. And so the first time that I got to play test a beta copy of the game with the voice tracks installed, and we had Michael Dorn, who played Worf in Star Trek. We had John DeLancey, who was Q. We had Mark Hamill. We had Alan Tudyk from Firefly. We had this just absolutely amazing voice cast of geek actors. And the first time I'm playing a game that I get to take credit in working on and helping design, and I get to hear Mark Hamill's voice in a game I'm working on, I'm just going, this is so cool. This is so awesome.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
Yeah. Sadly, I didn't get to be there in the studio when they were recording.
Well, it's available on Steam, and you can also get the Master of Orion Collector's Edition, which has all three games in it, which is absolutely amazing.
And, you know, in prepping to be a consultant on the new version, I had to break out, of course, my old copy and boot it back up and play it again a few times. And it's one of the few games that I worked on in my whole career that I could still play after it had shipped and go, this is still a fun game. Because usually by the time, as a producer, if you're working on the game for months and months and months, you're so sick to death of it by the time it ships that you never want to see it again.
Well, Jeff, what are you up to these days? Are you still involved in the games industry and anything like coming up from you?
In many ways, I am kind of like a ex-smoker or a reformed alcoholic, that when I got out of the game industry, I went cold turkey and haven't really played anything much more complicated than Words with Friends on any kind of PC in years. I'm working now. I've been working for Austin Community College for the last 5 years in our faculty development team and helping. We are one of the largest community colleges in the country, and we have over 1,500 faculty. And I've been helping them develop more effective and engaging teaching techniques, including applying gamification to the classroom. So I've been able to take some of what I learned as a game designer and apply it to actually learning useful skills in many respects. But I do still have shelves and shelves of board games, and I am eager for the pandemic to be gone enough that I can get back together around a table with friends and get back to playing Catan, get back to playing Ticket to Ride, get back to playing any of a number of the board games, Small World, and Eclipse, and so on and so forth, and Cosmic Encounter. So I'm an old school board gamer, and I still love doing that, but I can't play a computer game or a video game anymore without the designer at the back of my head going, well, that was a stupid idea. Why did they do it that way?
Once the designer, always the designer.
Yeah, yeah. So it's hard to enjoy a computer game or a video game anymore. And I never had the reflexes to be really good at most of the action games.
Yeah, and I find, if you're anything like me, that the older you get, the slower your reflexes go as well. I'm nowhere near as good as games they used to be.
Yep. And so, you know, getting a call to talk about games I worked on 40 years ago is a lot of fun and a lot of nostalgia, but it still reminds me that, hey, I'm like 60 now. I'm getting old. It's just, you know, feel like those old guys, Statler and Waldorf in the balcony of the Muppet Show.
Well, Jeff, it has been incredible to hear your stories. Obviously, you know, just some amazing companies that you work for and, you know, massive franchises that live on to this day. So we really appreciate you coming on and talking to us this week.
My pleasure. And I hope that you got enough that you can probably edit it down to at least 20, 30 minutes worth of stuff that sounds interesting and intelligent out of all this.